It is July 4th, 2026. 250 years ago today, a group of men signed their names to a document that bet everything on the idea that a new nation could stand on its own. And today, across airfields from Oshkosh to Falcon Field, the machines that defended that nation are turning engines and taking to the sky. I'm Tower on ATIS, coming to you on Radio Hangar. Bold Method dropped a Warbird quiz this week to mark the 250th birthday, and the questions they put together are genuinely good. Six aircraft, six questions. We are going to walk through every one of them today, and I promise the answers are worth more than the score, because behind each of these airplanes is a story about engineering, tactics, and the kind of flying that rewrote the rules of what aircraft could do. Before we get into it, a quick word from today's sponsor, AviationSoul.com. Aviation challenge coins built to mark the milestones, discipline, and pride behind every step in flight. From first solo to airline transport pilot, every coin tells a story. AviationSoul.com, a fitting mention on a day when we are remembering exactly what aviation has meant to this country. Now, question one. The North American P-51 Mustang, arguably the most famous American fighter of the Second World War. Here's the question. What design feature transformed the P-51 from a mediocre medium-altitude performer into the war-winning long-range escort fighter it became? The answer is the Rolls-Royce Merlin engine. Specifically, the decision to re-engine the Mustang airframe with a supercharged Merlin 61 series engine in place of the original Allison V-1710. The early P-51 was actually a disappointment. The Allison engine performed well at low altitude, but it lacked the high-altitude supercharger the escort mission required. The airplane could not protect bombers at 30,000 feet because it ran out of breath getting there. The British figured this out first. They installed the Merlin in an airframe received under Lend-Lease, and the result was staggering performance that embarrassed most of what the Luftwaffe had in the air. North American adopted the change. The P-51B and then the iconic P-51D with the bubble canopy entered service and changed the strategic bombing campaign. For the first time, fighters could escort the B-17 Flying Fortresses all the way to Berlin and back. That is a round trip of roughly 1,400 miles. With external drop tanks holding 110 gallons each, the Mustang was covering distances that German engineers did not believe were possible for a single-engine fighter. Here is the number that stays with me as a pilot. At cruise, the P-51D burned roughly 90 gallons per hour. To fly that 1,400-mile mission, crews were managing fuel across internal wing tanks, fuselage tanks, and two external drops. Drop them when empty or when enemy fighters arrived, then fight lean for the run home. All of that in a cockpit with no autopilot, in minus 40-degree air at altitude, often under fire. The Mustang stayed in military service longer than most people realize. The last combat use was in Korea. Warbird operators today still say it is one of the most demanding high-performance pistons to fly well. The handling rewards precision and will not tolerate sloppiness on approach. Beautiful airplane, unforgiving pilot's airplane. Question 2. The Chance Vought F4U Corsair. This one trips people up. The question, why does the Corsair have that distinctive inverted gull wing? The answer is the propeller. The Corsair was designed around the Pratt & Whitney R2800 Double Wasp, the most powerful radial available at the time. To extract maximum power from that engine, engineers paired it with an enormous 13-foot 4-inch Hamilton Standard 3-blade propeller. That is nearly 4.5 meters of spinning aluminum on a conventional wing. Clearing that propeller requires very tall, very heavy landing gear legs. The inverted gull wing was the engineering solution. By angling the wing root downward and then back up, designers got the gear attachment point at the lowest part of the wing, allowing for short, sturdy, lightweight gear while still clearing the propeller. The result was a clean, fast airframe that looked like nothing else in the fleet. It also created one of the most challenging carrier landing records in naval aviation. The original Corsair had a long nose that blocked the approach sightline and a bounce tendency in the landing gear. The fleet initially kept it off carriers. Marines flew it from land bases while the British Fleet Air Arm worked out a curved approach technique, coming in from an angled final that kept the runway in view longer. They eventually demonstrated carrier compatibility, and the Americans followed. By the end of the war, the Corsair had accumulated a kill ratio better than 11 to 1 over Japanese opposition. One of the war's most effective fighters, but it took real work to get there. Even today at air shows, Corsair pilots fly a wider pattern than most warbirds. That long nose is still a real factor. Experienced operators will tell you that consistent Corsair landings require dedicated type-specific training. The inverted gull wing is not just a visual signature, it is the engineering compromise that defined the whole airplane. Question 3. The Republic P-47 Thunderbolt, also called the Jug, which is short for Juggernaut, it earned the name. Bold Method asks, the P-47 was the heaviest single-engine piston fighter of the war. Approximately how much did it weigh? Fully loaded, approximately 17,500 pounds. Some configurations pushed past 19,000. We are talking about a fighter that outweighed some light bombers. The Thunderbolt was designed by Alexander Kartveli at Republic Aviation around the same R2800 that powered the Corsair. The engineering decision was to build the airframe as large and structurally robust as that engine could reasonably pull through the air. Pilots initially thought it looked absurd next to the slender profiles of German and British fighters, but it had gifts. It could absorb a remarkable amount of combat damage and still fly stories of Thunderbolts returning to base with cylinders shot out. Control surfaces partially destroyed, and hydraulics failed are common enough in the historical record that they define the type's reputation. The ruggedness came from both the structure and the nature of the radial engine itself. Radials can lose cylinders and keep running in ways that liquid-cooled inline engines simply cannot. At altitude, the Thunderbolt was genuinely fast. Above 25,000 feet, it could match or exceed most aircraft in any theater. It also dove extraordinarily well, fast enough that pilots began encountering compressibility effects, early hints of transonic behavior that would not be fully understood until after the war. Where it struggled was range. Early versions could not escort bombers far enough, which drove the Mustang's eventual adoption for deep penetration escort. But the Thunderbolt found its calling in ground attack. Armed with 850 caliber machine guns, rockets, and 500-pound bombs, the P-47 became one of the most lethal close air support platforms of the war. Its record in destroying Axis ground transport and rail infrastructure across Europe was exceptional. If you have ever stood next to a flying Thunderbolt at an air show, you understand the name. It is a genuinely large aircraft. The cockpit sits high, the fuselage is barrel-chested, and the R2800 at run-up sounds like controlled thunder. Fewer than 20 airworthy examples remain in the world. They are worth every minute of your time if you get the chance. Question 4. The Grumman F6F Hellcat. The Navy's answer to the Mitsubishi A6M0. Bold Method's question. The Hellcat is credited with more aerial victories than any other Allied fighter in the Pacific. What was its recorded kill ratio? The figure most cited is 19 to 1. Roughly 19 Japanese aircraft destroyed in air-to-air combat for every Hellcat lost the same way. The Hellcat's development is one of the fastest and most effective responses to combat intelligence in aviation history. Grumman engineers were given data from early Pacific engagements, including detailed analysis of a nearly intact Zero recovered from the Aleutians in 1942, and they built the Hellcat specifically to exploit Japanese weaknesses and neutralize Japanese advantages. The Zero was light and supremely maneuverable, but lacked pilot armor, self-sealing fuel tanks, and structural strength. It folded under sustained heavy caliber fire. The Hellcat was armored, had self-sealing tanks, was faster in a dive, and had a combat ceiling that matched or exceeded the Zero at the altitudes where Pacific air battles typically occurred. Grumman delivered the first production Hellcats in October of 1942, less than a year from the recovery of the reference Zero to operational aircraft in fleet service. That tempo of development is extraordinary by any standard. The Hellcat was also specifically engineered to be easier to fly and maintain than its predecessor, the F4F Wildcat. Wider landing gear for carrier operations, better visibility, more forgiving handling at the edge of the envelope. Pilots transitioned quickly, and the aircraft rewarded less experienced aviators. That mattered enormously when the early years of the war were consuming trained crews faster than they could be replaced. Grumman built 12,275 Hellcats before production ended. The Navy flew them in nearly every major Pacific engagement from 1943 forward. Question 5. The Boeing B-29 Superfortress. The largest American bomber of the war, and the most technologically complex production aircraft of its time. Bold Method's question. The B-29 used a pressurized crew compartment system that allowed the crew to operate at high altitude without oxygen masks. How was the forward compartment connected to the rear? Through a pressurized tunnel that ran over the bomb bay. Crew members crawled through this tunnel while the aircraft flew at altitude. The bomb bay itself was not pressurized, which is why the tunnel routed over it rather than through it. This sounds like a minor design detail. It was not. The Superfortress operated at 30,000 feet, where outside temperatures reached minus 60 degrees Fahrenheit and ambient pressure is a fraction of what we breathe at sea level. Without pressurization, crew endurance at those altitudes is severely limited. The B-29 allowed crews to work for 12 to 14 hours without oxygen masks in the pressurized sections. That was revolutionary for a bomber at the time. The aircraft also introduced a remote gun system. Instead of conventional manned turrets, gunners sat at sighting stations and operated remote-controlled turrets, using analog fire control computers. A single gunner could theoretically control multiple turrets simultaneously. This was cutting-edge system integration for 1944. The aircraft was enormously difficult to develop. The Wright R-3550 duplex Cyclone was powerful but ran hot, and engine fires were a constant operational concern. General Curtis LeMay, commanding B-29 operations against Japan, dealt repeatedly with engine losses that killed crews before any enemy contact. The Superfortress is, of course, most remembered for two specific missions in August of 1945. The Enola Gay and Boxcar history turned on those two flights. Two airworthy B-29s remain today. Fifi, operated by the Commemorative Air Force, and Doc, based out of Wichita, Kansas, where Boeing built many of the originals. Both fly the air show circuit. If you hear four Wright radials at full power, turn around. Nothing else sounds like that. Question 6. The Douglas SBD Dauntless. Possibly the most historically consequential aircraft on this list and frequently the one people know least. Bold methods question. The Dauntless was central to which engagement, often called the turning point of the Pacific War? The Battle of Midway, June 4th through 7th, 1942. In roughly 5 minutes on the morning of June 4th, Dauntless dive bombers from the carriers Yorktown, Enterprise, and Hornet sank three Japanese fleet carriers. The Akagi, the Kaga, and the Soryu went down in that window. The Hiryu followed later in the day. Four Japanese fleet carriers lost in a single engagement. It was a catastrophic and irreversible shift in Pacific naval power. The Dauntless was not the fastest or most glamorous aircraft of the Pacific War. It was outclassed in speed by most fighters it might encounter. But it was accurate, and in a dive bombing attack, accuracy is everything. The aircraft used perforated split dive flaps that prevented it from accelerating beyond structural limits in a steep attack run. Pilots could push over into a 60 or 70 degree dive, track the target release at low altitude, and pull out with confidence the airframe would take the load. Torpedo bomber attacks against maneuvering warships had historically produced poor results. Dive bombing from nearly directly above, releasing close, gave a much higher probability of contact. The Dauntless crews at Midway trained for that exact scenario and executed it against the most important targets in the Pacific. Lieutenant Commander Wade McCluskey, leading Enterprise's air group, extended his search beyond planned range and followed the wake of a Japanese destroyer to find the fleet. Lieutenant Commander Max Leslie arrived over the Japanese carriers with Yorktown's dive bombers at nearly the same moment. The coordination was not planned at that level of detail. It happened because both groups made the right decisions under pressure. Pilot and rear gunner flew as a two-person crew. The gunner operated a single flexible 30 caliber weapon from the rear seat. Against Zero fighters, that was limited protection. Dauntless crews took serious losses and pressed their attack runs anyway. The SBD designation stands for Scout Bomber Douglas. Fewer than 30 survive today. The ones that still fly are worth seeking out if you have never seen one in the air. So there are your six warbirds and six answers. The Mustang and what an engine swap changed about the air war over Europe. The Corsair and the propeller that drove a distinctive wing. The Thunderbolt and what 17,000 pounds can do pointed at the ground. The Hellcat and what the Navy built when it had the right intelligence. The Superfortress and the engineering that kept crews alive at altitude before the bomb run. And the Dauntless, which in 5 minutes on one June morning changed everything in the Pacific, 250 years of this country. The aircraft that defended it are flying today. Thanks to Bold Method for the quiz and to the museums, restoration teams, and warbird operators keeping this history airborne. Find us at radiohanger.com. I am Tower. Fly safe out there.